You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bow. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. With me in the studio across from the table is Neil Payne. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Chad, what's going on?
Neil, a sports writer at 538. You edit things too, Neil?
I do it all. I wear multiple hats, but not my backwards Met hat today.
That's true. You're looking nice and freshly gelled in your coif.
Not bro-y enough.
And across the country, instead of across the table, it's Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist. Hello, Kate.
Hi, Chad. Hi, Neil.
Hey, Kate.
How are you?
I'm good out here in L.A.
Yeah? Last time you were there, you were juicing, I remember, or you were getting juices. You had a great Hot Takedown banter about how you were converting to the juice life.
I had converted years ago to the juice life.
This is just a continuation of it.
Yes, exactly. Okay. And okay. I do have a green juice right next to me, so good call.
Yeah.
Juice life forever.
All right, on today's show... First, we will talk about the NBA Conference Finals, which have gone topsy-turvy since we last spoke. The Warriors are down 2-1 against the Thunder after a shellacking in Oklahoma City, and the Cavs have stumbled in Toronto, losing 2 on the road to Bismack Biyombo and company. Was the conventional wisdom about the best teams in the NBA all wrong, or is this just home court advantage rearing its head? And then a new piece at theundefeated.com by Mike Wilbon says that African Americans don't have much interest in analytics, and that may have serious repercussions in how African Americans are employed in front offices now and in the future. Neil and I talked to Mike about his piece for Hot Takedown. And then tennis is back. The French Open has begun without Roger Federer, who's sitting it out with an injury, but the rest of the usual crew is there, including Serena Williams, who's trying to repeat at Roland Garros, and Novak Djokovic, who's trying to win his first French Open. Our usual crew for tennis, of course, includes Carl Bialik, 538's own Carl Bialik. Carl will swing by to talk tennis, and then, of course, significant digits. All right, on to basketball. When we last talked, I think last week on Hot Takedown, the Warriors had lost Game 1 to the Thunder. At that point, we said that Oklahoma City had a 56% chance of making the finals, according to 538's model. This is based on ELO and all that stuff, but the point is that one game, one win on the road had totally flipped the favorite in that series. And now, after the second win with the Thunder up 2-1, the Thunder are now at 64% to win the series. Guys, what's happening in Oklahoma?
Craziness. That's what's happening.
Well, I know just in reading, right, that normally teams that win game three have a 69% chance, right, to go on to the finals?
Right. That's
or in
if
any
the,
series?
That's right, if the teams are evenly matched, if it's kind of 50-50.
So the reason that it's 65% is because of Golden State's historic season and taking into account the fact that every team that's played them is an underdog. They're kind of like eating back a few of those percentage points.
Yeah, exactly. I think the odds still consider, the power ratings still consider the Warriors to be a little bit better than the Thunder, despite how the Thunder have played in this series.
I mean, it's just like, it's just so hard to watch because, I mean, we talk every week about all statistically and how when you look at all the numbers, like this technically shouldn't be happening. And we do all these stat schools about advanced metrics, and it always starts at like a base level, right? Like where in basketball it's like field goal percentage, and with quarterbacks it's wins. And I can't help but thinking as I'm watching both series, but specifically the Western Conference, that maybe we just underestimated just like win totals for the season for these two teams and got too in-depth about like Golden State and how like they were off the charts in certain things, because at the end of the day, like Oklahoma City was the number three team in the Western Conference that had won tons of regular season games, and it was almost like we were underestimating the value of that.
Maybe, but I mean, Golden State won 73 games during the regular season.
Of course.
And OKC won only 55. So even if you look at that, I don't think it would be that different than the projections if you use really advanced metrics or whatever. That's a pretty big gap, to be honest. I think OKC has played well above their regular season performance in the playoffs in general, and particularly in this series.
Well, isn't there also a question of matchups, which is that, you know, win counts are spread out, obviously, over the whole league, and Golden State only played, I think, four times against the Thunder.
Three times,
and they won all three, right?
Right.
Yeah. And so, is there a possibility that, you know, do we have metrics, I guess, Neil, is maybe the better question, about sort of how teams will match up before they enter? I feel like I read a lot of subjective columns always about, you know, well, Kevin Durant's going to have a lot of trouble with Draymond Green on him or something like that.
I don't think we have very good stats for that still, at least in terms of just taking hypothetical combinations of, you know, lineups against other lineups or even rosters against other rosters and trying to figure out what on top of just the general, you know, the plus minus of the players or whatever kind of talent rating you want to give, or even ELO or whatever, and figuring out, okay, what of the stuff that doesn't get predicted well by that basic kind of point differential based stat is explained by other things, like, you know, one lineup being taller than the other or having more shooting than another or rebounding. We don't really have very good metrics for that. But one of the metrics that we do have, and probably one of the most reliable ones, our colleague Ben Morris wrote about this a few years ago, is that season series and the fact that Golden State swept it. And I know they needed some just Steph Curry heroics at various times during that, especially in one of the games, to win. But still, you know, sweeping a team during the regular season, I don't think it like overrides, for instance, if the records had been flipped and Oklahoma City had swept Golden State, that still wouldn't be enough to close that gap between 73 wins and 55. But I think it would have made up a little bit of that gap. And then the fact that it actually was in Golden State's favor would have suggested even more that they matched up favorably with OKC, not that there was some kind of matchup to be exploited.
Okay, so then, Neil, the only other two things, right, that are coming up when you actually watch these games, and I don't know how we statistically analyze it, is one, and I know we mentioned this last week, Golden State just does not seem to be in rhythm after Steph Curry's ankle and then knee injuries. And you saw when he was out that Draymond Green, Klay Thompson, and even at times Andre Iguodala had to play the role of, like, the go-to score. And now you're seeing in certain possessions, at least when I'm watching it, that there doesn't seem to be the same rhythm within that offense, and there seems to be guys thinking they need to take the key shots at certain moments that you didn't necessarily see before. I don't know how we analyze whether or not Golden State's offensive flow, not just their production, has shifted from the couple weeks before the initial injury to Steph Curry, and now that we have about four games since he's been back with the knee injury. And then the other thing is watching Oklahoma City and the athleticism they have on the perimeter and being able to play smaller and play super fast and athletic against Golden State. And Golden State's like won in various ways, but it feels like now, at the pace that Oklahoma City is playing and being able to defend on the perimeter and daring Golden State to play a little bit bigger and try and dominate on the boards and get more offensive boards, it doesn't feel like Golden State can match that pace.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how much of that is due to the fact that, you know, if there's some kind of weird effect where they started to try to learn to play without Curry, and then now that he's back in, even that little absence kind of took them out of the zone that they were in. Certainly to win 73 games, you have to kind of just, everything has to hit on all cylinders. So any slight disruption to that, I wouldn't be surprised if it played a role. And to the point that you made about the defense of the Thunder, I think that's been far and away the biggest contributor to the series so far, is just the fact that they've been holding this Golden State team that, A, it was the, I think, fourth best or third best offensive team of all time during the regular season, and had been, you know, playing well without Curry and even better with him, especially, you know, late in that Portland series when Curry was in there and just lighting the Blazers up, that Oklahoma City has more than held their own against this team. And that was going to be going into the series. We were kind of looking at whether or not they could do anything to impede the Warriors, and that was going to be one of the keys to the series. And so far, you know, Curry is still getting his, but Thompson and Draymond especially have been way below their usual efficiency level. So they're still, you know, carrying the load, if not, you know, in the case of Klay, carrying even more. And maybe that's a residual from when Curry was out, but they're just not hitting shots, and they're, you know, turning the ball over, and they're just not being as efficient as they used to be.
It's hard to say that that's just luck necessarily, and I would want to look for another factor than just, oh, they've been unlucky and they haven't shot the ball as well over the course of this Oklahoma City series, because we haven't really seen two games within a three-game span that this frequently where they're not hitting shots. So it could just certainly be like, oh, they had a couple bad shooting games, but I more so want to look for, are they taking the same type of shots in the same rhythm, in the same offensive flow? Because that's what feels like is off, and not just necessarily missed shots.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, and it sort of brings up the question. Neil, last week didn't you talk about whether or not the shots that were being taken were often being made? Weren't there stats around that? Am I making that up?
No. So they're using the kind of camera tracking technology. Right. They're able to actually put a probability on each shot that each player takes and then look and see if a team exceeds it or if, you know, if they're getting good shots, or how much of a team's efficiency is due to execution and getting those shots or exceeding
it. And that would clue us in on whether or not it's the Warriors who just are being unlucky, or if it's something that the Thunder are doing, right?
Right, and the weird part in this series so far is the fact that the Warriors, in both of the losses, the most recent games, they've gotten good quality shots. So that part has not gone away.
So that suggests that it may be luck.
Well, in one of the losses, they actually still shot pretty well. They just still lost the ball game. And then obviously in the most recent one, they got crushed and they had really a subpar shooting performance by their standards. So you could say that that's luck. But then again, Oklahoma City was one of the better defenses at suppressing that kind of shot-making ability that teams have. And so, you know, the Warriors were a shot-making team. It's almost like the immovable object against the irresistible force or whatever, where, you know, you have a team that's good at making shots, controlling for where they get quality shots, and then you have another defense that's good at stopping that, and they've come together. And so far, it seems like Oklahoma City is winning that, and normally we would say that doesn't carry over from game to game, but in a series, I think there's a chance that it might.
Okay, let's move on to the East now, where the Raptors have won two in a row, both of them at home.
Against the unbeatable, or previously unbeatable.
Yes, thank you, Neil. I had a quote written down. Let me just find it here. Quote, it looks like, this is before game three, it looks like nothing will stand in Cleveland's path to the NBA Finals, end quote.
What moron wrote that?
Neil Payne.
Oh.
Neil, is this just home court advantage? I mean, how much is home court advantage worth in this kind of thing? Is it such small sample that it could be any number of factors? Is it Biombo just like playing out of his mind? What's going on? Or Kate, whoever has a unified theory.
since I was responsible for the hot take. I mean, some of it is home court, right? Like the fact that the Raptors were playing at home. Typically, that home team in the NBA wins like 60% of the time. It might be even a little bit bigger in the postseason. But at the same time, our ratings going into these games, which do take that into account, thought that the Raptors would only win about 52% of the time against the Cavs, for instance, in game four. So that suggests that, you know, the gap between the two teams was such that it almost was enough to cancel out the effect of home court. And the Raptors, maybe you could spin it both ways, because you could look at it and say, well, they won with a slightly tilted, you know, coin flip in their favor twice in a row. It happens. But if you actually watch those games, too, you could see that the Raptors executed really well on offense, I feel like, especially in the past two games. And Kyle Lowry, who at times seemed like he might actually be checking out of the whole series and kind of, you know, he's their spark plug, he has played out of his mind, you know, some of the best basketball I've seen him ever play over the past two games. So I still think that Cleveland is going to win the series, but it certainly is far less likely than it seemed when it was looking like a cakewalk a couple games ago.
And I think the reason why I feel like Cleveland is going to win the series still is because it's almost like we've watched Cleveland play, and they've been playing this sort of flowy team ball all throughout the playoffs so far, and they haven't really needed to go to LeBron James as like, look, we need to win this series. You got to do whatever you do that you've done for the last 5 years to take your team to the NBA Finals that we saw, obviously, in the postseason last year of just like sheer winning games for this team. It feels like they're trying not to do that this year. And so to me, it's almost like this trump card in the back pocket where LeBron only took, what, one shot in the last 5 minutes of game four. And so you're like, okay, Cleveland's trying to win by playing this flowy team ball. And I think that they can. But then you could see if it got to game six or game seven, it would just be like, all right, no. They pull out that trump card, and I think we would see LeBron have that 40-point game.
Right, and some of the credit for that has to go to Toronto's defense and the fact that they've made this kind of devil's bargain, which is an interesting sort of strategy to take against the team that we saw, and we talked about obliterating the Hawks with three-point shooting. But they've basically decided, look, we're not going to let you get into the lane, or not going to make it easy for you, and we're daring you to make threes at the same rate that you have. And, you know, it's kind of been a mixed bag. They haven't actually suppressed the three-point shooting as much, but they've also really cut off some of the interior scoring of the Cavs in games three and four. And maybe some of that is, like you said, Kate, you know, if LeBron really, really wanted to and needed to, he could override that. But we've also seen cases of him in the past where he is just strangely passive, not so much in recent years, and maybe it's unfair to kind of harken back to earlier editions of LeBron that were more dependent on getting into the lane and kind of creating those shots. But I still think that, you know, it's going to make for really interesting basketball, at least from a series that we thought was just going to be a total walkover, to see if he actually can kind of make that counter adjustment and start reversing things, and then maybe that feeds on itself and gets better 3-point looks if they're able to kind of push the ball inside.
And at this point, from like a fan perspective, like, I'm happy that at least the Raptors are pushing the Cavs, not just because I want to see good series on both sides, but I don't want to see a finals where we think one team, the Cavaliers, have been like resting for a week, and then you've got whoever comes out of Oklahoma City and Golden State. Like, the fact that both of them are kind of in dogfights, to me, feels like whoever comes into the NBA Finals are at least going to be on even ground, or there won't be these like lopsided narratives going into the finals.
Neil, is there evidence that stuff happened? You know, I totally agree with Kate that I always think that rest matters when I approach it. Has anyone studied whether or not, you know, playing a 7-game series right before finals or any other playoff series really does have a drag on?
And if not, what? You have a piece of sign now, Neil.
Yeah, well, Andrew Flowers, one of our colleagues at 538, and I actually did do a piece on this when we looked at the start of this exact series, this Toronto-Cleveland series, because Toronto was coming off a Game 7 that was on a Sunday, and I think they had to play Game 1 of this series on a Tuesday, just a couple days of rest. Meanwhile, the previous game by the Cavs had been the previous Tuesday, I want to say. They had locked things up so quickly with the sweep of the Hawks. And so we looked at whether that actually made a difference for historical series, the amount of kind of that differential and rest going into game one of a new series. And it didn't really have that much of an effect. Like, the overriding factor by far was just how good do we perceive these teams to be without taking into account. And I know, you know, rest does matter in the NBA, especially during the regular season, where you do have to take into account things like back-to-backs and, you know, how many games and how many nights. But in a case of a series, one of the interesting things that we kind of thought about was the fact that after we had this sort of null result was the idea that people love to spin it one way or another depending on what happens, especially early in the series. For instance, if Cleveland had come out really, you know, kind of struggling, people would have said, oh, they're rusty. They haven't played in enough games recently, and so clearly Toronto had the edge. Now, of course, they ended up beating Toronto pretty handily, and so I didn't see any of these takes, but I'm pretty sure they probably existed, that people would say, oh, Cleveland's rest advantage really came in handy for them early in the series. So it is one of those ones where you can kind of see the logic both ways, but at the same time, the stats are kind of ambivalent about it. They're just like, how good are the two teams, basically?
Interesting. Okay, before we move on, let's just do 538's predictions for the rest of the Eastern Conference Finals. The Cavaliers are 71% chance to make the finals. Toronto has a 29% chance to make the NBA Finals. The only game that the Raptors are favored to win is Game 6, which is when they would be back at home in Toronto. And even then, it's just a 53% to 47% chance. So 538 continues to think the Cavs will turn this one around.
What I really love are those situations where the team that has Game 6 at home is up 3-2, and then it's one of those, like, you know that if you let it get to a seventh game, it's practically over. So that's almost like the feel of a seventh game, but in a sixth game. I like those. Yeah.
And now to an interview that Neil and I recorded with Mike Wilbon earlier, before Kate was with us, about his piece in TheUndefeated.com about African-Americans and analytics and why African-Americans don't use analytics to talk more about sports. But first, a word from our sponsor. Hot Takedown this week is sponsored by SeatGeek. Have you ever been frustrated trying to buy tickets online? Most sites make it complicated and then try to sneak in huge fees at checkout. That's why you need to try SeatGeek. They have made it easier than ever to buy and sell sports and concert tickets. So, you know, imagine you go to the Mets game, let's say. Imagine you want to go to Citi Field. Imagine that you want to figure out whether Matt Harvey is broken or just inside his own head. All you gotta do, go to SeatGeek.com, type in the Mets, look for the deal score that suits your needs. That's a score that tells you whether or not you are getting a good deal on the ticket that you're getting. Buy the ticket, but when you do, make sure to type in the promo code TAKEDOWN on the free SeatGeek app, and you're gonna get $20 off your first ticket purchase with SeatGeek. You download the app, you go to the settings tab, you click add a promo code, and then you enter promo code TAKEDOWN, and again, $20 free. Think about that. Don't pool multiple tickets into that same order. Have all your friends use the coupon too. It's cheaper for everybody. SeatGeek pulls all the tickets available on other sites into one place, so you save time and never miss a deal. You can also set alerts for upcoming games if you're thinking about maybe going, maybe not going. SeatGeek is the app to get you your tickets. So one more time, download the free SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab, click add a promo code. Enter promo code TAKEDOWN. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. Enter promo code TAKEDOWN today. Mike Wilbon is the author of Mission Impossible, African Americans and Analytics, Why Blacks Are Not Feeling the Sports Metrics Movement. It's a new article at TheUndefeated.com, which is 538's freshly launched sister site about the intersection of race, sports, and culture under the ESPN banner. Mike Wilbon, welcome to Hot Takedown.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. So what's the case you make in the piece, Mike? Give us the elevator pitch.
It's pretty simple. It is not a referendum on analytics, advanced analytics. It's basically an observation that I and others have made. And the observation is this. Black folks don't talk advanced analytics. Not at all. Like never, ever in the daily discussion of sports. It's not something we resort to. It's not something that frames our conversations. It's not something that is even included in our conversations. And by advanced analytics, I mean advanced analytics. I mean the things that have come into vogue in the last 5 to 10 to 15 years, most of them less than that, that we just don't use them. And it's not necessarily, again, a judgment on whether they're any good or should be used. It's just that we don't. I'm talking about Black folks of pretty much any age, and I talked to some current players in the NBA playoffs like Draymond Green and Sean Livingston and talked to all kinds of folks, and I found it really, really, really overwhelmingly consistent.
The people that you were talking to, were they sort of older people or younger? Or did it cut across different things? You said you talked to players. I get the sense that players in general kind of don't like analytics, no matter their race. But yeah, I was just kind of curious as to whether it was something that you sort of a sensation that you got just from, you know, being in the community and talking to people, or if you kind of sat down and kind of tried to take the temperature in a systematic way.
Both. Mm-hmm. It grew out of just a sort of a feeling. Like J.A. Adani and I were having this discussion, and we're like, We don't ever, ever include these sorts of metrics in our daily conversations, our discussions about sports. And that was just sort of two guys on the phone talking about people. And then this is in February. I think it was during the All-Star break or maybe it was Super Bowl week, but it was in February. And then I started, in the subsequent time, I just started listening in on conversations or having conversations or stopping people. I got a text message today from a young woman who's a WNBA veteran. She plays in Europe, I think, only now, but she played in the WNBA as well. And she said, there's no question you're right about this. I may use these things as a scouting tool, but I never, ever use them in my daily discussion of other sports. And so I started literally talking to people just randomly and of different ages because I thought, too, it might just be old folks. I thought it might be people of my age, generally speaking, and I'm 57 years old. That's why I talked to Draymond Green and Sean Livingston and other players. I included them because they're on the record conversation, discussions, remarks were very insightful. But I talked to, so I got a sample WNBA players, NBA players. I called people who scout, who have to use obviously advanced analytics and what they do. But again, I'm talking about our daily discussions. And culturally, they just don't register.
Now, Mike, presumably, like, the non-advanced numbers, like, you know, points per game or whatever, those are part of the conversation, right? Like, where do you draw the line between what does get included and, you know, is it just a matter of using numbers that, you know, people who are in analytics consider to be sort of the previous generation, or is there some sort of disconnect in that manner?
I think that's where the disconnect is. Sure, people can use batting averages, home runs, runs batted, and people use triple crown. But the advanced analytics people frown at that. That's not highbrow enough for them to use. They'll tell you that's not enough information. And so they have come by new ways of measuring those contributions. And what I'm saying is we don't embrace those ways of evaluating contribution. That's my observation. We don't talk about WHIP and WAR and wins above replacement ever. I'll tell you one that I laugh at personally. I mean, I'll just be personal about this. Possessions, points per 100 possession. Why do we need 100 possessions when a game is 48 minutes long? Why don't we just have points or whatever the measure is per 48 minutes?
Well, Mike, that's something.
100 possessions.
That's something that we actually kind of talk about here about, like, you know, different teams play at different paces. So, you know, you could have a guy's stats inflated, like his points per game inflated, because if he's on a team that's really fast paced, he gets more chances than other ones. So
that's per 48 minutes.
Right, yeah, but you still have to adjust for the number of possessions per minute that teams play. You know, if you walk it up the court, you're going to have fewer possessions than if you...
Adjust it for 48 minutes.
Right, yeah, I mean, as part of it. But what I'm saying is that, like...
going to 100, I'm saying, like you said, that there's a need.
Oh, sure, it doesn't have to be per 100. Yeah, it could be like, you know, 90 or whatever it takes for a 48-minute game.
48 minutes, a game is 48 minutes.
Right, exactly.
This seems to be a stretch to try and come up with things that are exclusive and impressive.
Yeah, I mean, I think
only engineers and mathematicians can understand, and I don't see the need for that.
Right. I think some of it is, like, do you think that teams, I found it really interesting that you mentioned that you talked to scouts who would use it. My understanding of what you said, correct me if I'm wrong, is they would use it professionally when they were trying to analyze players. But then when it came to, you know, their personal life or their fandom or whatever, they would kind of shift gears on that.
You don't shift gears. It just doesn't come up. It's not how we talk about sports. Black people and white people talk about sports differently. That's what I'm saying. Now, and when I say white people, I'm gonna make an exception to white people over 50. Tony Kornheiser talks about sports like I do, unless informed by producers about numbers that he doesn't really care about, or I don't want to say understand. I don't want to sound like I'm insulting his intelligence, but they're not numbers he would resort. They're not ways he would voluntarily talk about sports. And Tony's 10 years older than me. So if I tell you that the only way these numbers enter my life are in conversations with white people under 50, that would be exactly what I'm saying.
Have you used any of these analytics in your own analysis, whether it be on air or in your writing, or do they feel...
Almost never. I don't care about them. I don't find that they enhance my understanding of what is going on. I don't find that they enhance my understanding of the Warriors to know that they're scoring at a whatever pace per 100 possessions. Some things are excessive, and they don't really add necessarily to the overall knowledge and understanding of the product, and more importantly, the enjoyment for people. Again, I'm talking about just regular discussion now. I'm not. This was not a discussion about just people who make their living professionally dealing with sports in the sports industry. So for people sitting at home, it may not enhance their enjoyment of it at all. But there's certainly a presumption among people who deal with this intimately that it does.
So I want to get to the employment point that you make in your piece, which I thought was super interesting. You wrote that, quote, the reliance on this stuff seems to be a new safe haven for a new old boy network of Ivy Leaguers who can hire each other and justify passing on people not given to their analytic philosophies, that essentially analytics has become almost a euphemism for bias within sports front offices. And where are you drawing that from?
Observation. How many black coaches have been hired in the NBA this season, a league that is 75% or so black? How many black coaches? How many even interviewed for some of these jobs? I mean, this is common sense. I don't need analytics to tell me that either. That Nate McMillan, other than Earl Watson, who was retained from an interim position, of the new coaches hired, Nate McMillan is the only one. And hired by Larry Bird, a guy probably not particularly given himself personally to advanced analytics, to figure out whether he knows somebody who can play a coach.
Now, Mike, do you think that, like, what explains that, for instance? Is it a matter of opportunity, or is it are teams going down the wrong path by trying out analytics and having that be a gateway to the front, to working in a front office? Like, if it didn't work, why would they use it?
I mean, why are you presuming it worked? You seem to be presuming it's worked. Daryl Morey, a good friend of mine, fellow Northwestern Wildcat, I don't know that it's worked particularly there. They have to tear up another team.
Well, I think they're one of the winningest teams of the past 10 years. I mean, certainly the postseason success. We can kind of quibble about that.
I mean, I wouldn't see you're reducing it. You're marginalizing it. I wouldn't reduce the pairing of James Harden and Dwight Howard to simply it didn't work in the postseason. I mean, it's a spectacular failure this year. Yes, a year after they got to the conference finals, it's the biggest disappointment in the league. The Houston Rockets probably this year.
Fair enough.
So at some point, old-fashioned determination of chemistry, which cannot be analytically put together or measured, that some old-fashioned observation of that would suggest that you better get rid of these people no matter what the numbers tell you. You can't pair them. And so that's, again, so many of the things even you guys are asking me, they're presumed with a pat on the back that the numbers are so now superior that they make the game and the product more what? Accessible, better understood, more appreciated. I don't know that I accept any of that.
Sure, but I mean, I think we've seen teams that are analytic be successful also, you know, certainly in baseball. And I know you wrote about baseball as being a little bit separate.
Yes, I think baseball's a separate animal.
Right.
Yeah, I think baseball is given to this. And I think the people who understood this about baseball, I think then there became some transference. But I don't think the transference is valid. And who are the teams analytically put together that are superior in any way, shape, or form to the ones that weren't?
In baseball or basketball?
In basketball.
Well, I mean, certainly the Atlanta Hawks have been progressive in that department. Dallas Mavericks, especially when they won the championship in 2011, that was an example of a team that embraced analytics. They had an analytics guy sit on the bench during the finals. That's something.
Well, they've all embraced analytics.
Right, exactly.
And again, I'm not saying that I wouldn't embrace having this information. Again, my piece today is not a referendum on that. But what I hear, what I hear. And particularly is almost an offended, you know, tone from, and yes, I'm going to say this, white people, is that, wow, this is amazing. How can he say this? My piece says black people don't include this in their conversation about sports ever. That's the piece.
Mike, I want to get back to the employment part of your piece, which I think is interesting and does speak to whether or not we're going to have racial bias or racial equality within the front offices of various
leagues going forward. How about inclusion? I'm not saying bias.
Right. So it is, I think, as you point out, the case that when Neil and I are at something like the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference, which is this annual conference that's
MIT. There. You've been a panelist there, right?
Yes, I have been.
And that's a predominantly white audience, I think it's fair to say. Mike, would you agree with that?
Yeah.
And certainly the pitches that we get in and the people that we get into to 538 that want to do sports analytics are largely a white male audience as well. And
let me ask you a question based on that. Let me ask you a question. How often are they ever black?
Oh, very rarely. Yeah. We don't meet all of them, obviously, because some of it's over email.
Right. No, but you guys know your circles are vast. Your circles are vast to do what you guys do. My point is, you just came to the same conclusion that I did through a different sort of sampling. You are not encountering black people who do this. Amin's point is that, wait a minute, there are black people I went to school with who have expertise in these areas. Don't tell me that they're not interested in sports. And that is a very important point and speaks to your question. But you guys just came to the same conclusion I did from the other angle. You do this for a living, and yet you don't encounter black people who are involved in this. And neither do I. That's the piece.
Right, absolutely. And so, but I do want to get at this employment question, because I do think if the trend within sports, you said that almost every NBA team, for example, has embraced analytics. And so if the trend within sports is in front offices is that it's going towards analytics, are you concerned mm-hmm. that it's going to leave demographics behind because analytics is not necessarily something that is being discussed by African Americans?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that was part of the piece, and I'm glad Amin spoke to, because he could speak to it certainly more eloquently than most, in that he's at that rare intersection of being black and being involved in advanced analytics in an intimate way. And yes, I'm concerned, and he brought that part up. I had thought of it in passing. I had not thought of it in the great detail that he had and that he spoke to on the record. And I spoke to some other assistant GM types in the NBA, and they were pointing this out as well. Who are the people who are coming? Who's in the talent pool? And while Amin says, yes, there are people who are certainly qualified through qualitative analysis experience to do that, what is that? I don't know what that number is. That takes a whole different study. I mean, that's an examination of an entire different area. But we know this. As more and more of the owners come in with different backgrounds and largely dealing in marketing areas, then they're looking at putting together teams in a different way than people who had backgrounds 15, 20. I mean, Jerry Reinsdorf's background isn't the same as Mark Cuban's or Ted Leonsis's. Those are very different backgrounds and probably require looking at front office structure very differently. So the answer to your question is yes, absolutely. That would be that should be a concern of any person in any league that is looking to have front offices which are inclusive and diverse.
All right, Mike, I think that'll do it. Thanks for coming on, and obviously I think we come at these things from a different point of view, but I think especially the point about employment is something that both analytics and non-analytics folks can get behind, which is that if we want our sports to be inclusive and representative of all the people watching and playing them, that there is a risk of analytics becoming a gated community that maybe can't be pierced. Mike, thanks very much.
All right, thanks a lot.
That was ESPN's Mike Wilbon talking to Neil and I. You can find his piece on theundefeated.com, a new website that launched under ESPN's banner that covers the intersections of race, sports, and culture. Okay, now we are here in the studio with Carl Bialik, one of 538's writers and general tennis aficionado around the office. Carl, welcome to the show.
Great to be back.
You had a better title last time, didn't you? You were like international roving junior.
Tennis correspondent.
Yeah, tennis correspondent.
I think it was senior, but junior's fine as long as I'm roving and international.
So, Carl, the French Open is the Federer Open is happening already. Federer is not at the French Open. He is out with an injury. That seems to have been the biggest news, at least going into the tournament. What can you tell us about how rare this is around Roger Federer missing?
It just feels weird. It's weird for a Grand Slam to not have him in the draw, even when he doesn't make it far. He's still a fixture and, you know, one of the biggest draws early in the tournament and one of the biggest storylines, the biggest name in the sport on the men's side. But, he is going to miss this one. And he had made the last 65. That's a period of over 16 years that he'd been in every Grand Slam draw. So it really is weird.
I think you wrote in your piece on 538 about it that, was it Sampras and Agassi were number one and number two when the last time he missed a major?
Yeah, imagine two Americans being number one and two in men's tennis. That's how long ago it was.
And so is this a blip or is it an end of an era for Federer? You know, I feel like we've had the conversation around whether Roger Federer is done at least three times even on this show, let alone however many times out there in the sports talk sphere. Does this injury seem as though it's going to be something that permanently affects him, whether he gets back on the court or not?
You know, it's really hard to say. The most logical answer is the guy is almost 35, and that's pretty old for tennis, so this should be a reason for concern. On the other hand, he's had some other injuries late in his career, and he's come back really well from them. And also, this is always the Grand Slam it makes the most sense to skip. He had just played Rome, and while he didn't look great, he didn't look hobbled, and he won a match against a pretty good young opponent, but he never had a really good chance of winning the French Open in 2016.
It makes the most sense for him to skip because of his play, or for any player because it's so taxing?
Especially for him. It is taxing in that the rallies can be longer. Not as taxing in that it's usually not quite as hot as the Australian Open or sometimes the U.S. Open on hard courts. But it's also the one he always has had the most trouble winning. For him, that is. I mean, he still won it once and made a whole bunch of other finals, but at this age, with Nadal still probably owning him on clay, although they haven't played on in a while, and Djokovic being so good now on clay, Wawrinka kind of crushing him last year there, he wasn't really likely to win or really even go to the final. So I think it can certainly be looked at as just a strategic pullout to save himself for Wimbledon, the U.S. Open, where he made the finals last year.
So who do you think benefits from this in terms of, you know, tennis seems to be one of those sports where somebody like Federer, highly ranked player in the field, does tend to advance all the way to the semifinals most of the time. Is there somebody that seems like the odds-on favorite to kind of take advantage of that hole in the field?
Well, the funny thing is, if he were in the field, he would have had a quarter without any of the other top players. So any guy who was lucky enough to fall into that quarter would have probably benefited, because he probably wouldn't have gone that far given his injury and kind of rust. But since he's out, the main guy who benefits is Rafael Nadal, because he moves up from a number 5 seed to a number 4 seed. As a 5 seed, he could have played Djokovic or Murray in the quarterfinals, and both those guys have beaten him recently on clay.
Where are we, I guess, with Nadal at this point? Because we made so much, probably not quite a year ago, about he was, as we're talking about with Federer right now, that he was kind of on the downward slope. Now he's back on the surface that he loves best. Is he a guy that when you're watching him, you legitimately think he can win this tournament?
Absolutely. I wouldn't necessarily have said that maybe 7-8 months ago. He hasn't had a breakout result that kind of has overturned that narrative among casual fans tuning in during the Grand Slams, but he's been winning a lot of matches and playing Djokovic close. He beat Murray recently, so he's definitely in the mix, especially considering he's only lost twice at this tournament and he's won it 9 times.
And can we talk about Djokovic just a bit? He's never won the French Open. You said he is playing great on clay. So is it not a surface issue? It's just total luck that the best player in the game still hasn't broken through in this tournament?
I think it's a little bit of everything. One is, while he's been great on clay, he does have some tough losses on it. I mean, he's great on every surface now, so it's not clear clay is his best yet, and it might still be his worst. It's also been a pattern for him that when he's had tough matches late in slams, that he's then had trouble in the next match. So last year, for instance, he had a pretty tough, in the end, 2-day semifinal with Andy Murray, and everyone thought he'd win in the final, and he lost to Stan Wawrinka, partly because Wawrinka played great, but also possibly partly because he was taxed by the tough semifinal. So sometimes it's been weird things like that, timing, quirks. And then, you know, most of the time when it looked like he was finally going to break through and he didn't, it was because he lost to Nadal. So part of it is just that Nadal is so good on this court. And it's another good reminder that even when the surface is the same, a lot of things can be different. Just to give you an example, the main court at the French Open is really big. And Nadal loves, when he's playing defense, to roam way back in the court.
You're
on
saying
play.
Big in the sense that the fans are not right up on the dimension.
It's a good point. The dimensions of the court are totally in keeping with the rules of tennis, but there's the whole area behind the baseline where you can run around, and if you run into a wall, you can't run around. And this is a really, really big court where Nadal just plays great defense and where it's been so hard to kind of hit the ball past him. So something specific like that could make the difference between Djokovic, let's say, beating him like he did in Rome and losing to him like he's done so often in Paris.
So let's move to the women's side. Maria Sharapova is out. Angelique Kerber is out, who beat Serena Williams in the Australian Open this year. Roberta Vinci is out, who beat Serena Williams in that very memorable match last year in the U.S. Open. Is her path easier than usual? And we've spoken a lot on the show, obviously, about the quality of the women's field in tennis, but it seems like this the quality of this one's hampered because of injury or steroids.
Yeah. On the one hand, you'd say definitely her path has gotten a lot easier really early in the tournament. In addition to Vinci and Kerber, who were the last two to beat her at a Grand Slam, Victoria Azarenka, who many thought was kind of her biggest rival and looked like she was back to her old self this year, she was hampered by injury and she lost today. On the other hand, as Ben Morris, one of our colleagues, has written, Williams tends to do just as well against her best rivals, against the best players on tour, as against the worst. And we're naming now Kerber and Vinci as potential obstacles to her. But before she lost to Vinci, no one saw her as an obstacle. Everyone thought her path was clear at the U.S. Open last year to get the Grand Slam. And before she lost to Kerber, everyone kind of gave her that final at the Australian Open this year. So I think there is going to be a tough match or two looming. I think it's really hard to say which ones they're going to be. And if she starts facing some other top players towards the end, I wouldn't be necessarily that worried about it because she tends to do so well in those matches late in Grand Slams.
And Carl, I wanted your input on, like, we always talk so much about the next generation of female tennis talent here in the U.S. And obviously Serena hasn't retired or gone away in any case as soon as we might have thought, like 10 years ago. But one player who I watched at the U.S. Open a couple years ago is Madison Keys. And I know she's ranked like 15th. She's seeded 15th at the French and like ranked 18th overall. When you watch her, does she seem like she's someone who can take that mantle and actually win Grand Slams? Or she's still kind of like that one tier below?
I think she's still a half a tier or one tier below. She's still quite young, though, and she's going to just benefit from there not being that many all-time greats in that long kind of age gap between the Williams sisters and her. She has a lot of power, and she can overpower a lot of opponents. So this isn't naturally her best surface, but she's shown recently just how good she can be simply because of her ball striking abilities, even if this isn't her favorite surface to move on. She just made the Rome final and gave Williams a fairly tough match, at least a tough first set. So I definitely think, especially if a draw opens up, she could go far to slam as she has done before and even win one. I wouldn't favor her against Serena Williams anytime soon at a Grand Slam, but if Williams suffered an upset, especially on a different surface, I could certainly see Keys making a final and even winning in the next year or two.
And remind me again, Carl, when do women's players peak typically, age-wise?
It's a moving target these days. I mean, I think we've talked
about
it. I
know Serena's pushing 35.
Exactly. I mean, I think she's probably past her peak, but she's not that far below it. You know, it's been kind of a slow decline the last couple of years. And just the fact that she probably did peak or was at least near her peak, according to our ELO ratings, in her 30s makes a moving target. But it's also not just her. So I think probably the conventional wisdom used to be 23 or 24. Now we're probably thinking like 26. You know, we've had cases like Kim Clijsters, who retired for a few years, came back well past what people thought was the peak for women's players and won some slams and reached number one. So Keys may be away from her peak by a few years. She could still win it and keep getting better. And then again, all of this is relative. So Azarenka will probably still be around, but has had a lot of injury problems. Simona Halep's been really inconsistent. There aren't really that many players in their mid to late 20s who are looking like they're going to dominate for a long time.
All right, so Carl, it's the second round that they're still playing as we tape?
They're just finishing first.
Oh, they just finished first. Okay, yeah. So a lot of tennis still to come. Thanks for coming on chatting, and depending on what happens, we'll have you back to talk about the winners.
Great, thanks a lot for having me.
And now on to our significant digit, a telling number from the world of sports. This week, Neil Payne has been chosen to deliver the significant digit to us. Neil, what have you brought?
It's been appointed.
There was a council meeting.
Yes. So this week's Sig Dig is 40, and that's the number of hits that Ichiro Suzuki of now the Miami Marlins, a long time of the Seattle Mariners, needs to get 3,000 in Major League Baseball. And he had 10 hits in three games this week. There's a good piece at Deadspin by Tom Lay about just how Ichiro, he was a guy that really last year seemed like he might be pretty much completely done. For a guy who always prided himself on, you know, high batting average and being able to get on base that way. He hit .229 at age 41. He was a regular for the Marlins, but he was really below replacement level, something that we've talked about, wins above replacement, for the first time in his career. So he seemed like he didn't really have that much left to give. But in 34 games so far this season, he's hitting .417 with a .478 on base percentage and a .467 slugging percentage. And it really has been vintage Ichiro. He's done a lot of it as a pinch hitter. He's been moved in the regular lineup a little bit more recently with injuries to the Marlins ahead of him. But he had one of those vintage games on, I believe it was Monday night, in which he went 4-for-4, and his four hits were just laser beams to various different parts of the field. It was like vintage Ichiro, in which he, you know, just showed complete and utter control and really did make you think of the way that he used to be able to hit. So I'm hoping he gets a 3,000. And of course, you probably also heard that if you throw in his Japanese League hits that he had over the years, it doesn't even become close. Like, we wouldn't even have this conversation at this point. So if you include his 1,278 hits that he had in Japan, he's cleared this mark years ago. But, you know, even in Major League Baseball, that 3,000 hits means something. I mean, he's cleared 4,000 if you throw in Japan. But I think it's, you know, a good benchmark time to appreciate Ichiro. Right now, at least, he's playing like the player he once was.
Can we add a little love for the Jackie Bradley Jr. hit streak happening over in Boston? 28 games if he gets a hit tonight.
That double sig digging it up, Kate.
I just thought you had said everything there was to say about Ichiro there, so I just wanted to tack a little something on the end.
Sure, absolutely. You know, as another factoid about that that's been floating around is that he now has a longer hitting streak than Ted Williams ever had at any point in his career, which is pretty hard to believe, but also pretty awesome for Jackie Bradley.
Wake me when Jackie Bradley Jr. is hitting over 400. Okay, Ichiro deserves all the Sig Dig love. I remember when he first came to Major League Baseball. It was so amazing to be like a kid on a playground when Ichiro came, because his weird swing where he's running out of the box as he does it was such an easy thing to emulate.
Oh, yes.
As a too small child trying to find any way to get on first base in a little league team.
So, Chad, did you do that? Did you start your swing, you know, start running to first and kind of do it that way?
I tried, it led to the same results. And so I figured, you know, that my process, the outcomes were the problem, not the process.
And Chad, also, could you have hit 40 home runs a year if you really wanted to?
Absolutely. You've got my number. All right, that will do it for this week's show. Neil Payne, thanks.
Chad.
Thanks for doing it.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure.
Kate Fagan, thanks for calling in from the other side.
Thanks, Chad. Thanks, Neil.
Are we going to see you next week? Will you grace us in New York?
I hope so. I'm in Chicago for Sarah Spain's Memorial Day weekend wedding.
Ooh.
So I don't have a flight back yet.
Are you doing a radio show from from the wedding?
Yes. I'm doing the Saturday show from New York City, then I'm flying to Chicago and doing the Sunday morning show from there.
Wow.
You should webcast.
You should do it in the wedding tent or something, or just put the vows in.
Just interview people at the wedding as part of the radio show.
Totally. Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast foreman, who is still on jury duty, is Jody Avergan. And we got production assistance from Tony Chow and Jonathan Yales. You can email us at podcasts@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. Find us on your favorite podcasting app and on iTunes, of course, at itunes.com/538. Be sure to review and or rate the show while you're there. It helps others discover the program. Discover other programs, other 538 programs. 538 Elections, it's a podcast about elections. What's the point? It's a podcast about data in our lives. Neil and I also have a Mets podcast called Panic City. As Nate Silver said when he listened to it for the first time this week, it was exactly what I expected. Our theme song is
We'll let you be the judge if that's a compliment.
Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.